This is a conversation with Anne Weiser Cornell. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Serge.
So for you, teaching focusing is a mission in your life.
That's right. Ever since I found focusing in 1972, and it was hard for me to learn and yet completely life-changing, I've been on a path to make learning focusing easier for people, make it as easy as possible for as many people as possible.
Yeah, yeah. So make it easy for people to learn. So, you know, how do you make it easy? What have you been, you know, as you have stayed with it, you know, all this time and thinking about it and teaching people and learning from this, what are the things you have found out about how to teach focusing?
Oh, so many things. Thanks for asking. Well, one thing is, and I'm still learning, by the way, how to teach focusing more and more effectively, which is what makes it so much fun. And one thing that I find really interesting that I'm still learning about is that people are different. People have different learning styles, mm-hmm. and different modalities. And one person may get images easily, and images will be a big part of their focusing, where another person gets images very little.
Mm-hmm.
And so another big common difference between people is that some kinds of people like to enter focusing by talking, beginning to evoke an issue or a life question by talking about it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then it comes into awareness enough that they can kind of pause and get the feel of it. Whereas another kind of person is never going to be helped by talking. That's always going to take them someplace away from focusing process, and they need to really get their body,
mm-hmm.
pause and really have their really a kind of detailed, deep kinesthetic sense of their body.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that there are these interesting differences between people is a kind of a challenge for focusing teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that there really isn't one formula. Mm-hmm. One way. Although I must say I'm very excited when I find something that does seem to be common. It's like something you can say to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that pausing is a great example of that. The idea that focusing always starts with a pause. Mm-hmm. Really, a few years ago, really kind of spread throughout the focusing community and has been especially carried forward by William Hernandez in Ecuador, but I totally agree that the pausing is the step one,
yeah.
of focusing.
Yeah, yeah.
And by itself is a wonderful thing to do. But the other thing I've learned, one of the other things I've learned, is from what was hard for me, what wasn't easy for me. We learn a lot from that. When I first learned focusing in 1972, there was no clearing space. There were no steps. Those steps came along a few years later when Jen Lin assembled his work so that it could become a popular paperback.
Mm-hmm.
When I first learned it directly from him and his other students, there were not steps. But there were questions. So we were to somehow find our body and be aware and then look for problems or issues or look for the place where we felt things.
Mm-hmm.
And then when something kind of emerged from all that, we were to ask it questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had a hard time with that. I thought, well, if you ask it questions, then it's going to open a little mouth and talk back. And it didn't. And then I thought, well, there's something wrong with me. But I was saved by watching experienced focusers focus.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, and I think this is always true, is that the best way to really get focusing is kind of by osmosis. In other words, being in the presence of people who actually are focusing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is so much more effective than trying to get a series of steps, no matter what the steps are,
mm-hmm.
from a book or a piece of writing.
Yeah.
So it's what really worked for me.
I can, as you describe it this way, it's a little bit as if we're trying to describe to somebody how to ride a bicycle and say, so you put your leg this way and decompose the movement and they get lost. And you see it and you get it, yeah.
Well, and at least in the bicycle, it's external, so we can show pictures. But the thing about focusing is a lot of it is internal,
mm-hmm.
and we can only use metaphors when we talk about it. But mm-hmm. yes, when we see it happening, we can get the feel of it. So from that point when I realized that, I've always incorporated in my teaching times when I simply focus in mm-hmm. front of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even have a partner or a companion.
Mm-hmm.
I just use the group as my silent companion, and I just demonstrate focusing by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hate to see beginners not have a lot of examples. And I still don't do this as much as I'd like to. I have lots of examples of watching experienced people focus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then another example of a way that something that I learned. So a few years later, Gene's book did come out, and I was one of the people he invited to help him teach focusing. Because when his book came out, Focusing, first in 1978, but then in the very popular paperback form in 1981, he started getting requests from all over the world for workshops. I don't think he expected that to happen. He's like, okay, they want workshops. Let's have workshops. And he would put together these weekends in Chicago at the International House. And he'd invite, you know, anybody he knew who knew focusing to come help him by being assistants at his workshops for free, of course. But we loved it. It was so wonderful. And I never got tired of assisting Gene with his workshops. But by that time, he had clearing a space as step one of focusing. And there were six steps, you know, and you do those six steps. Well, the trouble with that was clearing a space never worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was effective for me. Because I have the kind of process, we called it distant process, where it takes a long time for me to get anything. And then once I get that, you're sure not going to make me set it down, are you? It took me so long to get it, you know. So pretty quick, although for several years I just followed Gene and taught the way he taught. As soon as I began teaching on my own, I had to very quickly start with what I was saying earlier, teach different ways for different people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And say to people, you know, if you're this kind of person and you have this kind of process, you'll want to do this. And if you're this kind of person and have this kind of process, you'll want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have just one method, even though focusing itself is very simple. Now, Gene always said, the steps are not focusing. The steps are simply a rope across mm-hmm. the territory. And when you know the territory, you don't need the rope. But I'm proud of the fact that I was one of the people who started bringing into the world alternative lists of steps. He had his six steps,
mm-hmm.
and people, and I was one of the first, started to bring into the world alternative lists of steps. And the more alternatives there are, the more possibilities there are for people to find their own way, to find a way that works better for them.
Yeah, so we're not talking about the true way or the real way of focusing or a better way to focus, but really, actually, though, what the steps do is a sense that there's so many possibilities, and it's about customizing, you know, what works for you, what works with your own process, so you're not doing something, but you're actually finding your own process that corresponds to how
you're
function.
You're finding your own process.
Yeah.
That's right. The more different alternatives there are, the more you can feel, oh, focusing is this big thing with lots of room in it for me. And with lots of room in it for me to find the way that works for me, that's, that draws a little from this, draws a little from that. I remember a conversation I had with Gene about how his website at that time talked about the six steps.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Gene, I have a problem with that phrase. He said, well, tell me about it. I'm happy to hear. I said, it's not the word six that bothers me. It's not the word steps that bothers me. It's the word the. And he said, oh, and he completely got it. And the website changed. And, yeah. and it's like, okay, we have six steps rather than the six steps.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a change I'm really happy to see.
Yeah, because it's actually such a freeing process. And instead, trying to shoehorn it into, you know, there's one way to do it.
Well, and I, you know, in a way I do understand, because one of the most challenging things that any focusing person ever faces is to answer the question, what is focusing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
So, that's so, like, so actually, let's play this game. And so, if I were to ask you, what is focusing?
Well, let me just finish my thought and I will answer that. I'm just saying I forgive them.
Yeah.
I've often heard people answer that question by saying focusing has X number of steps and therefore da 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 da. But I think you have to avoid that.
Yes.
You can't use steps, which are a teaching tool, to say what focusing is. You know, why is focusing hard to define? Why is it that we can't say what it is? It's okay, so focusing is a body-based awareness process in which you pay attention, a certain kind of open, aware attention, to something that's forming and unclear. That would be my one.
That sounds great. I certainly love the paying attention and the forming and unclear feels very beautiful. What I was thinking when I was just a minute, I asked you the question. I was thinking of what you said at the very beginning, and you were saying something about the pause. And so what came to mind as you were talking was that sense of, well, focusing is something that happens when you take a pause. And then you pay attention to that something that's forming, you know, and unclear as you described. But so, you know, almost describe it as a phenomenon, as something that happens, as opposed to a thing.
It isn't going to work. It isn't going to work because a lot of things happen when we pause.
Yeah,
we
could
start daydreaming. So we can, as a definition, it's going to work to, I mean, I'm assuming that such a definition is meant for people who don't yet know what it is.
Yeah.
And so I think pausing can go into our definition, but really technically it's a prerequisite.
Yes, yes.
Pausing allows the possibility of bringing a kind of open, non-judgmental awareness to this funny thing that is a forming, that's called a felt sense.
Yes.
Now, and, you know, having been in the focusing world now for, I guess, 42 years, 43 years, I've often met people who say, oh, those people over there in that piece part of the world, are they seem like they're doing focusing.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, oh, tell me more. Well, they're having people feel in the body. Okay, tell me more. They're having people ask questions of themselves. Oh, great, great. Is there a felt sense? You know, are they having people pay attention to something unclear where there's a sense of there being more than can be easily put into words? And it always turns out they're not.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, actually, as I liked, as you started to compare focusing to things that are like focusing, and you, what you just did, you say, well, are they paying attention to a felt sense? Are they listening to the unclear? This was a very nice way to actually define focusing in contrast to things that are similar and how it's different.
Yes. It's always come down to that.
Mm-hmm.
The felt sense is it. It's the dividing line. It's the defining characteristic of gentle lens focusing. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to get interested in is I think that the term felt sense has not been broadly understood. And I take responsibility for that because when I wrote my first book, The Power of Focusing, 1996 is when it was published, I didn't understand felt sense. I wrote the second most well-known book on focusing, and I did not understand felt sense. And in that book, you will see, you know, inaccuracies because of that. And it's not until I really engaged with studying Gentlen's philosophy that I understood what a felt sense is, even though he'd been saying it clearly all along.
But maybe let's talk a little bit more about that, spending more time with a felt sense in light of this process model. You know, what comes up for you about the felt sense?
Well, let me just say that I think the way that felt sense has been commonly used and the way I understood it in 1996 is that it's a body sense that's always available. It's your kind of ongoing body awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually that definition is now becoming more and more broadly used, not only in the focusing world, but you hear it all over the place in modern psychotherapy discussions.
Mm-hmm.
People will say, that's my felt sense of it. But what I think Gentlen means by felt sense, and I've got his book right here. I mean, his book, Focusing Oriented Psychotherapy, which I just adore. He says that, the felt sense forms freshly here and now. And so it can't be the way you were feeling all day.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you are feeling all day is significant. It's interesting. We do want that to be some kind of starting place, but it isn't what he means by felt sense. And so what he means by felt sense is something that gels, that forms, that kind of, he uses the term, falls out at some point. And he says the forming of the felt sense allows us to feel more fully ourselves. And here's my favorite quote about the felt sense. Page 20 in this psychotherapy book, with the emergence of a single bodily sense, a felt sense, comes relief. As if the body is grateful for being allowed to form its way of being as a whole. It becomes something you have, not something that you are.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process model, he actually says that... when the felt sense forms the problem, we're living in a new world in which the problem is already solved,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing. If I had been assuming up until then, we have a felt sense, it hurts, we spend time with it because of some way that we spend time with it and that more comes from it, then we have a felt shift.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when we have a felt shift that the world changes and we live in a new world. Gentlen doesn't say that. He says that the key moment of change is the forming of the felt sense itself.
Right, right. And so, you know, so I like very much the way you describe it. It feels very nice because, and again, with the contrast, you describe to say, okay, so there's felt sense, felt shift, you know, and this almost a mechanistic model where, you know, there are parts. And in contrast, you know, we're talking about something where in a way the felt sense is the experience of the shift happening, is the, you know, being in process and the movement. And that's one side of that experience that's how we become aware of the experience, but it's not a part of an experience that is, you know, where the step are happening.
When the felt sense forms, something remarkable has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is just a revelation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a
mm-hmm.
whole different approach to the human change process.
I mean, it's a very different approach because instead of, in a way, it's the approach of that the movement is happening. So in a way, we're observing something as opposed to trying hard to make it happen.
Well, exactly. Trying hard will not work.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So yes.
Right. But then, you know, but I became interested in, especially because I was going in the 90s, I went through some personal, very tough personal issues. And so I became interested in, what is the experience of being really stuck? What is the experience of having, life issues? Writer's block was one, but also I was using alcohol addictively. So what is that experience of having a repetitive stuck issue, obviously related to trauma, and to try to bring focusing to that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what I eventually found working with Barbara McGavin, what we eventually found was that something else needed to happen before we could even get a felt sense. That getting a felt sense actually wasn't possible when we were in the we now call it a tangle, when we were in the tangle of this really stuck, difficult life issue.
Which makes total sense based on what you just mentioned about what the felt sense is. That
right.
if it's stuck and you don't have that movement, then you cannot be aware of something that's not happening.
That's right. That's right. So we felt the need to kind of develop a method that would come before being mm-hmm. able to get a sense
mm-hmm.
that would deal with. As it turned out, we were actually developing a way to deal with parts, what we call partial selves. Now, if you want to look at partial selves or parts, you know, many methods work with parts. The most famous one these days is the internal family systems of mm-hmm. Richard Schwartz. We've also got the psychosynthesis, Assaz Joly's approach. We've got voice dialogue. Gestalt was the way of dealing with parts and so on. Jinla never claimed that focusing was a way of dealing with parts, although our whole parts work was inspired by something that he did say. It's when he was teaching focusing and he would say, to do focusing, you need a friendly attitude. And somebody would raise their hand and say, but what if I can't be friendly? And he would then say, well, then see if you can be friendly to that. Okay? So if not being friendly is a that,
mm-hmm.
then it kind of opens a whole door
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
something. And so kind of based on that and continuing to develop the work that Barbara and I call inner relationship, which is a turning toward, more explicitly a turning toward any experience that arises. We realized that in these difficult, stuck, tangled areas, what was going on is we were being identified with parts, that is, you know, using Jendlin's process model, what we understand parts to be is a kind of the apparent existence of an inner entity because of stopped process.
Mm. Mm. So let's slow down a little bit because that's a beautiful, but it's also hard to follow. So
so
in a way you get, you know, because of the stuckness. The process is stopped, and so you take that moment as being who you are. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, and people, you know, yes, people get identified with smaller, less than whole aspects of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, anytime somebody says, you know, I am scared. Maybe not any time, but often when people say, I am scared, they're actually identifying with a less than total aspect of themselves. And if they'll shift their language and say instead, something in me is scared,
mm-hmm.
I am sensing something in me is scared, they actually have the experience of, oh, I'm still as scared as I was, but it's part of me. Now I can feel that I'm more than that.
Yeah. So it's, in other words, putting a container so that scared is within that container I am. as opposed to being who you are. And you're more the container than the scared part.
And so more and more we didn't need to do any kind of clearing of anything or moving or setting things out, because if you get bigger, what your experience is can stay the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
It can be in the place it needs to be, in the intensity it needs to be, and you can just get bigger. But the thing about stopped process is that in really tough, stuck areas of life, you don't just get scared. You get scared repeatedly and in a similar way. It's at the same kinds of situations and at the same kinds of narrow parts of situations. It's what Jenlyn talks about as frozen structures. What does he call that? Anyway, structure bound, being structure bound.
Mm-hmm.
So structure bound experience means you're only responding to partial aspects of it, like only that person's an authority figure and not that they're a whole person,
mm-hmm.
or only that person is physically beautiful and not that they're a whole person. And the subtle, and you're not responding to the subtle and rich, complex elements of a current situation.
Right.
So we get structure bound. Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially, like in a traumatic situation where we're going to be hypersensitive to that aspect we're scared of, and then we have the tunnel vision of only seeing that part and then being reliving in that traumatic moment.
And it does seem to be related to trauma. It seems to be related to what the body does in response to trauma of freezing, encapsulating, shutting down. But that, you know, you can look in your current life.
Mm-hmm.
At all kinds of less than optimal ways of living, all kinds of constraints on free interaction, and start there and say things like, okay, something in me wants to express myself more fully, but another something in me is afraid I'll be laughed at, is ashamed,
mm-hmm.
And that kind of recurring pattern, those elements inside can be treated as if they're temporarily, or they seem to be, or they're evidently entities.
Mm-hmm.
There does seem to be something in me that is always stopping me from self-expression.
Yeah.
Not just now, but repeatedly.
Yeah.
But what we would say is that's not really a permanent entity. It's rather something that seems to be an entity because the stoppage keeps
right.
happening at the same place.
But which
does that
be,
make sense?
Yeah, it could be simply conceptualized as, say, a neural circuit, a pattern where in a certain situation, then certain circuits are going to be just the default mode. And so
you can do that. You can do that. You can see it that way too. Yeah.
Yeah.
However, you know, healing and freedom mean being able to respond freely, with more possibilities and with more availability. And it turns out that you can, using a focusing quality of attention, you can heal those kinds of stucknesses as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the work that Barbara and I did that we call Treasure Maps to the Soul, because it turns out that those difficult areas of life are treasure maps. They show where the treasure is.
Mm-hmm.
And the treasure being really the unlived aspects of self, that in us which has been unavailable or not fully available until now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what you're describing is a sense that in the stuck areas, there's a freezing, a repetitive quality, that pattern, and actually that becoming conscious that this is only a part of you as being all of who you are. You are bigger, and that bigger you, that bigger I, has the possibility to then pay the kind of attention that we pay in focusing, and in a way disentangle this, not be stuck in that, default mode, but be able to imagine other possibilities, be able to find a sense of movement, to follow the implicit movement, and then we come to life. And in that sense, a beautiful part is that that moment of stuckness is actually the gateway to the treasure map.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there's a reparative process. There's a healing process of relationship mm-hmm. that probably is exactly filling in the missing relationship from the original trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Because trauma, as you know well, is not what happens to us.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma is what happens after it happens. It's mm-hmm. whether or not we have somebody there who can help us resolve what just happened. If there's somebody, if there's an environment at the time that allows a resolution of the hurt at the time, then it doesn't become a traumatic experience.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if there wasn't, and there often isn't, then that gets carried by the body as a stoppage.
Yeah.
And so this inner relationship from self or self in presence to the hurt part, to the hurt places, it in a way mirrors or matches or duplicates what was missing. And we have Jenlin's wonderful chapter in his therapy book, chapter 23, I think it is. It fills itself in. No, it isn't chapter. It's chapter 22. The organism can fill in what should have happened in its infancy and early childhood. It can even do it relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful concept.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he bases that completely based in his theory because what is implicit, what's implied, remains implied. If it doesn't carry forward, it remains implied.
Yeah, and I think that what I like about this thing of that bigger I is that, in a way, that's the same relationship as a child to a loving parent, which allows the child to overcome what could be traumatic by containing it, and that in that inner relationship, you have the big I that actually functions in a way to allow for that implicit to keep going instead of being stuck.
It does. And as you say that, I feel like adding and that almost always happens. Maybe we can say always happens as well in the context of an interpersonal relationship of focusing partnership or of therapy or of friendship. So we're not asking of ourselves that all alone we give ourselves everything we need,
mm-hmm.
but that we are that for ourselves and that we feel the greater strength, capability, resiliency, and so on that we really have by being able to offer to ourselves just what was needed, just what was missing. I did actually a session this weekend as a demo, and the woman said at one point, "Oh, I have everything I need inside myself." Uh-huh. And this beautiful beaming smile came over her face. And it's such a wonderful moment, isn't it?
Yeah. So truly healing.
That's right. That's right. You know, and many people are interested nowadays in attachment theory, and the evident fact based on research watching caregivers and babies that both caregivers and babies seem to be, they're calling it hardwired, right? Ready, mm-hmm. ready for a certain quality of interaction. Well, this is in Jenlin's theory, and it always has been.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it the blueprint. He's always said the baby is born ready for the breast, and the breast is ready for the baby. By breast, of course, meaning that not just the physiological aspect, but the whole interactional
mm-hmm.
possibility there. And so people are just beginning to see that, to suspect that what's happening in good therapy is healing of attachment wounds.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that in every focusing session, really, there's an inner relationship that's healing.
So I'm tempted, you know, as you describe this, to find a thing that maybe we could suggest to people to tweak a little bit next time they do focusing, to pay attention to something a little differently, you know? And so what would you say about that?
Well, you know, I wanted to say that I've pulled five skills out You know, partly this is part of the mission of spreading focusing, inspired by Pat O'Midian and Nina Joy Lawrence, who've taught tens of thousands of people some focusing in Pakistan and Afghanistan. They do it by giving people skills that they can teach other people. And how can I do that? Well, I picked out five skills and I put them together into a free e-course that I call Get Bigger Than What's Bugging You. So I will tell you those five skills and let's have our listeners try them. And if any of these five skills are new, then any of them would be a nice addition to people's next focusing process. And the first one is to use the language something in me. So something in me feels upset, something in me feels sad. And rather than saying there is fear, something in me is afraid. And just feel that difference. Because when we call an experience by a noun, when we call an experience fear, it becomes an object. And emotions are not objects. But by the language we use and the way we think about them, we can make them more object-like, and then they become more frightening, more hard to deal with. So everybody notice what happens when you take a sentence like, I have fear, or there is fear, and change it into something in me is afraid.
Yeah, and that there's two points there. That's the point you made earlier about something in me, and the point you're making now about is afraid, as opposed to using a concept, a rigid word. Yeah.
Well, if you start with the phrase something in me, you're gonna have to follow it with an adjective.
True.
And not a noun.
True.
So it really sets you up to do it the way that will be most effective. The second skill is saying hello to it. And I give Bebe Simon the credit. She's the first one who I know brought saying hello really widely into focusing. And it's, I'm going to say hello to it. I think that's a very especially empowering thing to do if one has a strong experience, like I feel a lot, like a strong choking sensation, or there's a lot of grief or something like that. And I'm going to say hello to it. And by being the one who says hello, my eye gets stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, they say, oh, I don't know, how do I find this nice, large self, this calm self, this compassionate self? I feel shaky. I feel unsure. I'm not sure I can ever find a part of me that's that confident and calm. I said, no. Don't find a part. Just say hello. When you say hello to something that needs hello, you have just become the one who can say hello.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the hello is another relational move that people can do.
Yeah.
The third one, yeah, did you want to comment on
that? No, just I'm noticing that, the saying hello is noticing the desire to run away from it or to ignore it. And so by just noticing it, before you say hello, you already start noticing that you are a person, you have agency, and you have a choice, which continues your point about that's a gateway into feeling that bigger I.
That's right. Bebe likes to say, hello is not I love you.
Right.
You can say hello to something that you don't actually like.
Yes.
It's okay to say hello. Or if hello sounds odd, we can say, I'm acknowledging it, or I'm saying to it, I know it's there. And yes, exactly. You're exercising your agency. Yeah. And you've shown up.
Mm-hmm.
Showing up is
yep.
so powerful. So
yeah.
powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this third one has that agency quality as well. The third one also, for times when something's feeling kind of strong, stressful, or difficult, it's let a gentle hand go there. So I'm letting a gentle hand go there. There meaning wherever, you know. Sometimes my hand just finds a place in my body that I didn't even know was troubling me, or sometimes my heart hurts or my throat is tight. I'm letting a gentle hand go there. with the hand, we're saying, I am with you.
Mm-hmm.
So the hand is a very easy way to, another very easy way to find this experience of presence to the self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, so the touching in a literal way.
And I've had occasions when I was working with somebody who I hadn't worked with before, and I would say, I remember working with someone who was having serious anxiety, and my heart is beating fast, and as often happens with anxiety, her anxiety was making her more anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh my gosh, it's getting stronger. And I said, maybe you can be with it. And she said, I have no idea what you mean by that. What do you mean, I be with it? That doesn't make any sense to me. I said, okay, well, let's see. How about letting a gentle hand go to it? Oh, she said, that I can do. Oh, is that what you mean?
Mm.
So the hand is so concrete.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It becomes something that, again, like saying hello, it's something we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentle, let a gentle hand go there instead of put your hand there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it has the quality of allowing and letting mm-hmm. that Chen Lin talks about in the chapter 8 of Process Model. So that's number 3. Number 4 is I am sensing. So when we have the something in me phrase, if we add I am sensing something in me, there's another dimension to it, as we noted earlier. Not just something in me is upset, but I am sensing mm-hmm. something in me is upset. Now I am here.
Mm-hmm.
So each of these little moves is reinforcing the same pathway.
Yeah, the building up that big I. Yeah.
That's right. Building the big I. There are 5 different moves for building the big I, and the 5th one is to say to it, no wonder. So it's empathy. In the 2-word phrase, no wonder, or you can say, of course, but no wonder is so nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to it, no wonder. And that too builds the big I. So those, yeah, I'd recommend that if people haven't tried those before, they can use any one of them, not only in a focusing session, but really in the midst of life,
mm-hmm.
in a stressful moment or whatever. And if you want, there's the e-course that has all those moves and examples of them and lots of encouraging and encouragement for giving them a try. That's on my website, focusingresources.com. You can just get that e-course for free.
Well, thank you, and
this is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.